Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of February, 100 years ago today. Rosa Parks was born, and we learn a great deal about her life and pay tribute to her during the hour that is ahead. Our guest this hour writes, "The reach of Parks' political life embodies the breadth of the struggle for racial justice in America over the 20th century and the scope of the roles that women played. The fable of an accidental midwife without a larger politics has made Parks a household name, but trapped her in the elementary school curriculum, rendering her uninteresting to many young people. But the variety of struggles that Parks took part in, the ongoing nature of the campaign against racial injustice, the connections between Northern and Southern racism that she recognized, and the variety of Northern and Southern movements in which she engaged have been given short shrift in her iconization." Well, no longer, not with the writing of Jean Theo Harris's book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Jean is a professor of political science at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. She received her undergraduate in Afro-American Studies from Harvard and her PhD in American Culture from the University of Michigan. And she has written extensively on Black freedom struggles and contemporary politics of race in this country. We should also add that she is from Milwaukee. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Jean during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you would like to leave a message there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Jean. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the title of this book. I found it interesting that you very carefully chose the title that you did. You called her Mrs. Parks, but you juxtaposed The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Why that title, Jean?
I wanted to highlight sort of the breadth of her life, and it was a life of rebellion, of resistance. She calls it a life history of being rebellious. That's her quote. So she really sort of sees her, you know, what we know her for, which is her bus arrest, embedded in a much larger life of struggle, and I would add, of courage. And then you mentioned the second half of the title, the Mrs. Rosa Parks. Black women like Rosa Parks, right, were routinely denied that sort of formal honorific. So partly I wanted to put the Mrs. in the title to give that kind of formality, but also to sort of make a stop. I think Rosa Parks rolls off the tongue so quickly that we assume we know her.
Yes.
And so I wanted that degree of formality, I think, to make us kind of realize that we don't know her fully and that she's not ours fully. I think she's become sort of a national hero, but in many ways, in very narrow ways, and I would argue ways where we often don't stop to sort of see the kind of breath of what makes her actually a national hero, I would argue.
Mm-hmm. The other thing, you had so much material because, as you write, her life really takes on a whole century, and the work that she did in many different areas in many different parts of the country also takes on a whole century of the struggle for racial justice. It's a huge life.
It's a huge life. Both she lives a very, very long life. Right, she lives, you know,
right,
to be 92, but she lives a very long political life, and so it begins. She is raised by her mother and her grandparents, and her grandfather is a supporter of Marcus Garvey, Pan-Africanist, sort of Black nationalist Marcus Garvey. Right, so it begins there. That story begins there. She marries Raymond Parks. Raymond Parks is working on the Scottsboro case when she meets him. The Scottsboro case is nine young men, young black men, ages 12 to 19, who are arrested on a train. Two white women are found on the train, and so the charge quickly turns to rape. The nine young men are sentenced to death. And so a local grassroots movement comes up to try to defend these young men. Raymond Parks, who Rosa Parks describes as the first real activist she ever met, is working on that case when she meets them and when they get married. And so sort of that's where she gets her adult political start, right? So that's the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. Then
the 1940s, 1943, she sees a picture of a friend in a picture of the local NAACP, and she realizes that women can be part of the branch. And so she goes to her first Montgomery branch NAACP meeting. is actually the only woman there that day and elected secretary, and so she will spend a decade before her bus arrest working for the NAACP and working with Edie Nixon, who will come to head the branch, to turn the branch into a more activist chapter. And so they're working on voter registration, they're working on school desegregation, and they're working to document white brutality and legal malfeasance. Mm-hmm. So this is very dangerous work that she's doing already in that decade, even before the bus arrest.
Yeah, and after, and we'll get to the bus arrest in a moment here, yes. But after the bus arrest, she is, and I don't think that we know this history very well, Jean, she is subjected to all kinds of death threats. It affects her health, her husband's health, her mother's health. And this goes on for a long period of time. What a way to have to live.
Right, and I think we don't often think about the kind of cost or the kind of sacrifice that she makes, right? And sort of how long. I mean, I call it really a decade of suffering in the book because the impact on her, on her family, and their economic health and their physical health sort of lasts really for a decade.
Right. The image that we have, and tell me how we got this, it seems to have been in lots of people's best interest to portray her, including those people who really embraced her, who were part of the movement, of this tired seamstress who was quiet, who was polite, who didn't want to be uppity in any way, who was just worn out, couldn't give up her seat, make her a more sympathetic figure. How does that enter our ideas of who she was and how we remember her when she was really, as you write about so well, so much more?
I mean, I think part of how that enters is, so she is arrested in 1955. We are in the midst of the Cold War, right? And the always civil rights activism sort of was seen as the work of outside agitators and was often portrayed as the work of outside agitators. Very quickly, she is called a communist plant. She is red-baited. She is called an NAACP plant, right? And so in many ways, the movement, sort of Martin Luther King, the Black Press, Parks herself, tend to kind of put forth sort of that she's a Christian, that she's a seamstress, or she's actually, you know, she's an assistant tailor in a downtown department store, but they tend to sort of hold up that aspect of her in many ways as, you know, to keep the movement safe, to keep her safe.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I, you know, and I write about this in the book, she, you know, part of why the community galvanizes behind her is this is a long time coming and there have been many acts, but part of why the community galvanizes behind her is because they know her, they respect her, they trust that she can stand up under the pressure that's going to come onto anyone who makes such a public stand, right? So her politics are key to, you know, one of the keys to why, you know, sort of people rise up in this moment, but they also in many ways are backgrounded to keep the movement safe again because this is sort of the height of the Cold War.
You mentioned the fact that there had been other acts before hers, and you write about those in the book. Do you want to highlight some of those?
I mean, in the decade after World War II, there are a number of people in Montgomery who make stands on the bus and who are arrested. She has a neighbor in 1950 who was actually killed by police for his bus resistance. In March of 1955, you know, 9 months before she makes her stand, a young 15-year-old Claudette Colvin is arrested for refusing to give up her seat. So there is a history of people making these courageous acts, and Rosa Parks was well aware of this and the kind of cost of making such an act. And then Rosa Parks herself has actually also done acts of resistance on the bus even before, again, December 1st, 1955. Rosa Parks hated the practice. Many Montgomery bus drivers would make black people pay their money in the front, get off the bus, and reboard in the back. Mm. And Rosa Parks hated this and refused mm-hmm. to do this. And so it had run-ins with various bus drivers, including this very bus driver, for her refusal to do so and had been kicked off the bus before. One of the interesting things that happens that night is the bus driver goes one step farther and has her arrested. But she had been kicked off the bus before for her acts of resistance.
And why does he do this? Tell us more about, we don't ever hear about this bus driver. He could have just kicked her out the bus, but arresting her, little did he know what was going to happen as a result of that arrest, huh?
Exactly. Edie Nixon, again, the fellow activist Rosa Parks, calls it the worst decision Blake ever met. James Blake is the bus driver. He's right about Parks' age. And he, so when she basically refuses, he says, I'm going to have you arrested. She says, you may do that. So he gets off the bus, and he first calls his supervisor, and his supervisor says, you should, you know, you need to put that woman off. The supervisor does not say, from what we can tell, you know, have her arrested. So then Blake calls the police, and the police come, and Rosa Parks believes, in one interview that I was able to find, that the police did not want to arrest her, that they feared trouble. Not that they knew who she was, but that they feared, she believes she heard the word NAACP, but Blake, she believes, you know, sort of takes the step and agrees to come down after his route to sign the arrest warrant, and so she is arrested and taken, you know, taken to jail for a few hours. They do not manhandle her. She does not resist arrest in that moment. She, I think, is very much thinking about, you know, the young Claudette Colvin had gotten charged with resisting arrest along with the segregation charge, and so Parks does not resist, and so then she is taken to jail for a few hours by the police.
Mm-hmm. And what happens to me, Jean, is so remarkable in the whole history of the civil rights movement, is this bus boycott that goes on for the longest period of time, and I'm sure people who were in it were, and she as well, I think you write that when it started, nobody was sure what was going to happen, but it was a huge event, and it was an event that really brought Dr. King to prominence as well. So can you talk about both of those things, how huge it was, why it was so huge, and if it's true that if it were not for what Rosa Parks did, there may not have been a Dr. Martin Luther King as prominent as he was.
Right, right. No, it is huge, and I mean, she, you know, she does not believe when she makes that stand on the bus that this is what's going to follow. One of my favorite quotes in the chapter about the arrest is she talks about her arrest being annoying and irritating to her. And I think that speaks to how she sort of sees this as a kind of distraction from the political work she's doing. She's organizing a youth workshop for that weekend, so she's worrying about that. And so in the moment, she doesn't necessarily think anything is going to come up and come from this. She had been at Highlander Folk School, that it was an adult organizing school in Tennessee, 5 months before. And on the last day, they do that go-around to say, well, what are you going to do when you get back home? This is sort of an activist organizer training. And she says, well, the resistance is too high. There's never going to be a movement in Montgomery, a mass movement, but I'm going to work with the young people. She had been working with the young people of the NAACP for a while. So this is 5 months before she makes her stand. She says that there's never going to be a movement. So, yeah, that weekend, so she's arrested on a Thursday. And it's actually the Women's Political Council that calls the one-day boycott for that Monday when she's going to be arraigned in court. And everybody's very nervous that weekend. You know, will people stay off the bus? Will people stay together? And again, this is at first just a one-day boycott on the Monday. And then this amazing thing, and so many, Parks does, King does, so many people talk about that morning and seeing the bus empty and what that was like. And then there's this big mass meeting that night at Holt Street Baptist Church. It's packed. There are thousands of people outside on the street that can't get in. Mm-hmm. And it is there that they resolve to sort of turn this into an indefinite boycott. And that is partly enabled in the coming weeks by the organization of this amazing sort of carpool system. They set up 40 sort of pickup stations around Montgomery. People donate their cars. And basically, people drive people around so you can get to work, so you can get to the doctor, right? And that this amazing organization is part of what makes this boycott. I mean, this boycott goes on for more than a year, right? From December.
Remarkable.
It's remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what Parks does during that year is they send her all over the country, and she's fundraising for the Montgomery Improvement Association, which is the group that comes up to support the boycott, and for the NAACP. So she's going all over, partly to get funds and partly to turn this sort of local struggle into a national struggle.
Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, she's kind of broke. That was an interesting part of this. You would assume everybody was taking care of her, but she didn't have any money.
Right. So she, 1 month into the boycott, so she's working for the biggest department store downtown. She's an assistant tailor in the men's shop, and 1 month in, they let her go. So she loses her job, And then her husband, he's a barber at the Air Force Base, and they basically say there can be no talk of the boycott or that woman in the shop. And for Raymond Parks, right, he is a political man, that is untenable. And so he loses his job. So, both of them, he barbers on the side some, she sews on the side some, but they, neither of them are able to find steady work in Montgomery ever again. And so she spends that year, right, doing a lot of fundraising while her own family is in economic, trouble.
Right. Yeah. And what about King? Is he reluctant to join this? Did he have to pause for a long period of time to make up his mind, or was it yes right away?
So King is so young, right? King is 26 years old.
Goodness.
When she is arrested, they have just had their first baby. The baby is 1 month old, right? So he's brand new in town. He's pastoring at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, right downtown, right across from the Capitol. And so Edie Nixon decides that once the Women's Political Council has decided to call this boycott, Edie Nixon, a longtime organizer, understands that they need the ministers to start to speak out about the boycott on Sunday. So he calls, at 5 in the morning, calls Reverend Ralph Abernathy, and then he calls this new young minister in town who had been coming and active in the NAACP since in the year that he'd been there, by the name of Martin Luther King. And he wants to use King's church because it's centrally located, and also because King is new in town and he doesn't have any, enemies or, alliances. So he will be a sort of a neutral figure. And so he wakes King up at 6 in the morning, and King says, well, can you call me back, right? It's 6 in the morning. We have a new baby. I'm new here. And, because he doesn't know he's Martin Luther King in neon, like we know. He's going to become, but in the moment, he is like all of us, right?
It is. Yes.
It is a decision that has to be made. Nixon calls him back. King says yes. Nixon says, well, that's good because I've already been telling people we're going to use your church, right? So, and then, that first mass meeting night, right, King is very nervous, right, and he hasn't had time to prepare his speech. And really that's a real first, our first look at what Martin Luther King is going to become. And that speech that King gives at Holt Street Baptist Church that night is a beautiful speech. But, he comes into this leadership, and it's not easy. Right, his house is bombed. This is Martin Luther King, 26-year-old Martin Luther King, kind of coming into kind of this amazing role. But had Rosa Parks not been arrested, had not a lot of other people in Montgomery decided that this was going to be a movement, maybe who knows?
Right. Yeah, it was so important. Let's spend a moment talking about her political philosophy. Mm-hmm. The other part of the book is after she's moved north and she's in Detroit and she's working for John Conyers. Mm-hmm. But she also has an alignment with Malcolm X. And you write at one point, Parks saw nonviolent direct action and self-defense as interlinked, mm-hmm. both key to achieving black rights and maintaining black dignity. In regard to self-defense, she found herself closer in philosophy to Malcolm X than King. And I'm wondering, could you tell us, how was she more aligned with King in a political philosophy, and how with Malcolm X?
So, she gets this sort of longtime belief in self-defense from her grandfather. Her grandfather, after World War I, right, there's a real uptake in Klan violence and in Alabama and Pine Level where they're living. She very much recalls her grandfather sitting out at night with a shotgun to protect them. She was very much raised and believed in the idea that you tell people what you're going to do to them, right, that this act of sort of self-defense and self-protection. Raymond Parks, again, this Scottsboro organizing is hardcore, right? I mean, they have gun in that, for self-defense, mm-hmm. Which is true during the boycott. That said, the kind of power of organized nonviolence that kind of emerges in the boycott in the, with King, in the, ensuing years after that, sort of delights her and amazes her. And it's this, kind of way to both gather kind of community power, but also as a kind of rebuke to what, segregationists are trying to do. And so she very much delights in it. But she retains you know, a belief that you have the right to self-defense. And then, and in many ways, that is, that makes her, so that, I think that part of Malcolm X sort of makes sense to her. As, you know, as you mentioned, you know, she moves north in 1957. You know, she's, you know, she is reading, she is an internationalist, she, you know, all of these issues that Malcolm X is also raising, right, about sort of seeing the black struggle in an, you know, international context. You know, the, you know, critique of Northern sort of hypocrisy, right? All of these also resonate with her. So there are many ways that she, you know, finds commonality with Malcolm X, and there are many ways that she finds commonality with King. I mean, her faith really underlines her, you know, steadfast political work over decades, right? And so that faith, right, and that belief in sort of faith in action, right, I think very much, you know, she delights in King. She, you know, she's amazed by King, right? I mean, she's 42, right? This young 26-year-old Martin Luther King, right, as it is for many people in Montgomery, it's just, it's this amazing thing to kind of watch, you know, in your midst, sort of this happens.
I imagine. And but I want to go back to the faith thing in a moment, but at some point, refresh my memory on this, I'm recalling that she witnesses King getting roughed up by somebody and he practices nonviolence. And how could you not be struck by that? I think she was there, wasn't she?
Yes, and she's just, she's awed by it, yes. So she sees him get it, sort of, he gets like attacked by a woman at a, like a talk he's giving, and that he doesn't sort of seek to kind of protect himself, and he asks people not to hurt her. And, you know, yeah, she is just, she is very much awed by sort of that capacity. And that, you know, and that capacity, it, you know, in a real visceral sense, right? So that it, as he's being hurt, that he doesn't have the sense that he wants to strike back. So absolutely, she goes and gets him an aspirin and a Coke because she feels like, well, that will help him. He, you know, his head's going to be hurting. You know, she sort of seeks to take care of him in that moment, but also I think is very much awed by him.
We welcome phone calls for Jean Theo Harris. Let me give you our phone number and tell you again what we're talking about. Today is the 100th birthday of Mrs. Rosa Parks, and Jean Theo Harris has spent the past 10 years, if not longer, researching the life and has just done a wonderful job of giving us a full understanding of this woman who was involved in the struggle for racial justice for most of the past century. It wasn't just sitting down on the bus. The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks is the name of Jean's book. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, or you can always leave a message for us on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Jean is from Milwaukee. She grew up in Milwaukee. She's a professor of political science at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York and is the author of this tremendous biography. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We started phone calls for Jean Theo Harris with Art in Milwaukee. Hi, Art.
Hi, Jean. I took out of the library your book on the Northern Civil Rights Movement a few years ago, Know Your Parents, and I heard your interview on Democracy Now! This morning, as well as what's on now. So that's wonderful. I'm wondering whether you have any plans to be back in Milwaukee either during Black History Month or Women's History Month so that we could put together the Bus Drivers Union and the Civil Liberties Union and NAACP and a bunch of folks to have an event.
I would love to. My parents still live in Fox Point. I grew up in Fox Point, as you know, so I would love to come.
Do you have any plans to be back here?
People have been talking to me about doing an event in Milwaukee. It's not set yet, but I'm certainly open to it. And we've been talking also about an event at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. So I would love to come.
Okay. You still have your email at CUNY Brooklyn College?
Absolutely.
Sure.
All right. Plans will be made.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank
thanks
you.
Very much.
Thank you so much.
What are you doing? You just said you did, or Art said you did Democracy Now! How are you spending Rosa Parks' 100th birthday?
I'm actually in Detroit. There's a whole day of events here in Detroit. In many ways, again, marking that Rosa Parks was as much a Detroit sort of figure of courage and activist as she was a Montgomery one, even though I think we know her very much for the Montgomery work. But she spent more than half of her political life in Detroit. She worked for John Conyers. She helps him get elected the very first time in 1964 when he's running for a new congressional seat. One of the first things he does is hire her. This is her first paid political job. And then she just continues working on Northern injustice, right, in Detroit, around jobs, around housing, around schools, around police brutality. And she continues to be active with sort of, you know, more national organizations and mobilizations.
Do you think that if he hadn't hired her, he would have been elected? He would not have been elected?
No, I mean, but he very much credits. So he's running. This is a new congressional seat that's been redistricted. This is 1964, and he is a young civil rights lawyer, and he's running on a kind of upstart campaign of jobs, peace, and justice. And so he, like Mrs. Parks, is an early opponent of the war in Vietnam. And part of what happens is that they persuade Martin Luther King. She persuades Martin Luther King to come to Detroit on Conyers' behalf. And King is not doing any, you know, he's really staying away from this kind of political work, but he can't say no, and party can't say no, probably to Rosa Parks. And so he comes and does an appearance for Conyers. This is Easter weekend, 1964. And then Conyers wins that primary in September by less than 100 votes.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, it's just, I mean, there are eight people running. He is not the favorite. He is not. And so I think, I mean, she's volunteering in his campaign, and then she gets King. And so, and I think he really sees her, this is what he told me, as kind of the most important civil rights activist in the state. And I think very much she kind of embodies this kind of both sort of, you know, older and new civil rights politics that he's kind of, you know, he's setting about to kind of put forward again as he goes to Congress in 1965. This is when he's first elected to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he has had a huge, long career. He continues to be in Congress.
Right. Thanks, Art, for your call. George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Yes, hi. I had heard that the actual date of time when she was arrested for the bus, that it was actually a planned event, perhaps by the NAACP, and she was considered to be a sympathetic figure to perhaps carry out this plan. Could you speak to that?
Yeah. So it was not a planned event. She was not a plant. In fact, I think many people, and I think Parks herself, had thought about what she would do, right? Particularly after Colvin is arrested in March, right? I think there's a lot of reflection. But I think for most people, sort of what you think you can do and what you, you know, talk about doing, and then what you find yourself being able to do in the moment on a crowded bus, the bus driver has a gun, right? So she doesn't know. In fact, that day she actually passes up a more crowded bus to, you know, and decides to go to the drugstore to wait for a less crowded bus. That idea of her being a plant actually starts right immediately in Montgomery among segregationists. They call her a NAACP plant. They call her a communist plant.
Mm.
So that the idea that it's a plant is a myth.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, they're, part of the reason that I think the community galvanizes behind her is certainly strategic, right? She's 42 years old. She is very active in her church. She has been very active, you know, in politically and in the community, and so people also know her, and they trust her, and they also trust that she's not going to flinch under the kind of pressure that's going to come upon anybody who kind of dares to make this kind of public stand. So there are all sorts of things that go into she's very kind of middle class in demeanor, we could say. So all of those things become factors as to why she becomes sort of a good person, and she becomes this person that people kind of galvanize behind. So there's certainly a strategic aspect of how people kind of mobilize behind her, and certainly part of that strategic aspect is also kind of the ways that people start to background her politics, right? So King, many of the kind of local leaders that, you know, don't talk so much about her politics because this is the Cold War. And they, you know, to keep kind of the movement safe. but it was not a planned event, or she is not a plant. So I think it's sort of a mix of those things.
Yeah. I think that story is widely told, what George has said. That's what we believe, that it was a plant, that it was all planned action. And I was surprised to read in your book that it was not.
Right.
It was very spontaneous. You talked earlier, Jean, about her faith in action. Was her faith what was guiding her in all of her work in her lifetime or not?
I mean, I think there's no way to understand how you can be an activist for so many decades and sort of put yourself into situations that are so terrifying, right, without some sort of, whether it's religious faith or spiritual faith or political, sort of, you know, a deep, you know, kind of core. And so I think certainly her religious faith and then certainly her political determination are part of what kind of keeps her going, right? I mean, she spends a decade before this bus arrest, you know, they're trying to do all of these things, trying to kind of challenge all of these practices and having very little success, right? And that takes a lot of, you know, faith, and I think faith in a religious sense and then faith in a kind of personal or political sense to kind of keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly I think for Rosa Parks, part of that is a religious faith and a faith that, you know, kind of that justice will prevail, and a faith simultaneously that requires that you sort of act in the world.
George, thanks very much for the call. There's one, boy, this guy could put together words, couldn't he? This, you quote King in one part of your book talking about, he writes in reference to her, "No one can understand the action of Mrs. Parks unless he realizes that eventually the cup of endurance runs over," and that's what happened on the bus.
Which is a
beautiful way to put it. It ran over,
right. That sort of, she talks about in various ways, she'd been pushed as far as she could be pushed. You know, she very much hates this idea of her kind of feet being tired, and that's why she makes her stand. She very, you know, in her autobiography, she talks about the only tired she was tired of giving in,
mm-hmm.
right? And that also she felt like if she actually was, you know, stood, that she was sort of consenting to this sort of treatment, and she did not consent. So it's very much, again, a kind of core act of civil disobedience, right, where it's like, I do not consent to this treatment. I will not get up.
Yeah. Let's go to Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. I think anyone living in the South at that time is somewhat familiar with Highlander Folk School,
mm-hmm.
because there were billboards throughout the South. Highlander was, quote, a progressive institution. It allowed communists, open communists, to attend the sessions, and this was not at all the approach of liberals. The billboards would have Martin Luther King seated beside O'Dell or some other communists at the time, and of course Parks trained there. I didn't know till you mentioned that their husband had been involved with the Scottsboro stuff. And, of course, the campaign to save the Scottsboro boys was led by the Communist Party and its front group, the International Labor Defense. In fact, I was in Montgomery picketing in the 60s. But my real purpose was to do research on the Scottsboro case, and I have something called an article that's still cited, the NLA versus the Communist Party, in which I show that the Communist Party actually saved the boys.
Jean,
mm-hmm.
Your response.
I mean, I think absolutely. So if we talk about Highlander, she goes to Highlander in August of 1955. This is to attend a two-week workshop on school desegregation. As you know, that we have the Brown decision in 1954, but then there's Brown 2 in 1955, right? The Supreme Court comes back and says, you know, they don't put any timetable on it. They say, you know, the very famous phrase, like, with all deliberate speed. They're looking for desegregation with all deliberate speed. They give the implementation back to the states. Now, many people, including Miles Horton, who runs Highlander, and many activists, local activists like Parks, realize that this means that people are going to have to push for the implementation of the decision themselves. It's not going to happen. And so she goes, she takes 2 weeks off of work to go to this workshop at Highlander in August. And And then she will sort of maintain this relationship with Highlander, right, over the next many years, including, as you talk about, there's this very these pictures that end up being put on billboards across the South, basically, right, to say that King attended a communist training school. But what you didn't mention about those billboards is that Rosa Parks is also in that picture, right? She's sitting next to King. They are there for the 25th anniversary of Highlander. And there's a picture shot where King is sitting there listening, Parks is sitting there listening, Miles Horton is in the picture, and there is a man by the name of Abner Barry who is a communist at the time, and so he's in the picture, and this has becomes proof this is a communist training school. And right, there's all of this red baiting of Highlander and of Parks and of King. That she, again, endures not just the year of the boycott, but that continues, right, for many years.
Yeah. And actually, I want to talk about Highlander in a completely different way. Highlander, and she is connected for a long time with Highlander, and it has sort of this, on a very personal level, it seems to me as though it was striking to her, Jean, that she was in a dormitory where black people and white people were sleeping in the same room, they were sitting at the same table, just on very human level, it was important in her life.
Oh, I think there's no way to understand her stand, like, outside of also kind of this transformative experience she has at Highlander. She talks about it as the first time that she could talk with white people where she didn't feel any hostility. Right, one of the things that she delights in is waking up in the morning and knowing that, like, white people are making her breakfast.
Right, imagine that.
Imagine that. Yeah. And that just also, she goes there, she's fairly burned out, right? She's very, you know, kind of, they've been trying all these things, they haven't been going anywhere. In many ways, this is why her friend Virginia Durr, who she also works for, recommends that she go. She's a tremendously inspired. One of the people leading the workshops is Septima Clark. She is a black school teacher who has been fired from her job as a school teacher in South Carolina because she refuses to give up her membership in the NAACP. And Parks finds her enormously kind of inspiring and sort of a mentor because Clark is so calm and Parks feels so not calm. And so I think it very much serves as this kind of what is possible, right? And then I think she takes that back. And both kind of the situation in Montgomery is, I think, perhaps becomes even harder to bear post-Highlander. But I think it also gives her a vision of sort of what's, you know, what can be possible as well.
More phone calls in a moment. Jean Theo Harris is our guest on this, the day that Mrs. Rosa Parks would have been 100 years old. Jean has spent a number of years researching and writing The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, and she is with us this hour. Jean is also from Milwaukee. The name may sound familiar to you for a number of reasons, but she is from this area. Here's our phone number if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message, there is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jean Theo Harris, our guest this hour, her book is The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. And we go to Ken in Janesville. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I think we should know that Sojourner Truth was thrown off a bus three times. I mean, the last time she was actually manhandled and got the bus driver fired. But in 1863, right after the slaves were freed, I mean, this tells you how long it's been going on. Two times she was kind of shoved back to the back of the bus, and she wouldn't go. But the third time, the bus driver just grabbed her and threw her to the street and hurt her and put her in the hospital, and that made the newspapers, of course.
Jean.
Right. I mean, I think there's a long history of bus resistance, and particularly also of bus resistance among African-American women. Ida B. Wells also thrown, and train resistance and streetcar protest. Ida B. Wells similarly has a similar situation on the train. Pauli Murray historian Blair Kelly, in her book Right to Ride, talks about this whole long sort of history of resistance. So, I mean, I think one of the kind of myths that Rosa Parks is the first to do this, right, is just that, you know, it's not borne out when you actually look at the history, right, that there is this longstanding sort of, you know, that there had been people over the years that had done so, right? What's different in this case is that we see a kind of mass movement emerge in Montgomery.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ken. Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Hi.
Good morning. With regard to our friend Hugh's comment, and we haven't heard from you in a long while, why does it seem that in Rosa Parks' case and many other situations where progressive or humanitarian people or groups get training or information or insight from American communist or socialist background, that is considered to disqualify, eliminate what they are doing. It seems rather to me that raises the stature of those groups, such as Highlander, that we owe them a favor for helping us through the civil rights period with their insight and their training. They should be commended rather than using that as an excuse to condemn people like Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King.
I mean, I think we want to remember that, right, that one of the ways to just discredit civil rights activism, right, was to just call, to sort of say it was un-American, right, in the period of the Cold War, to say these people were communists, right? Even if people had no ties to the Communist Party, right? That people who were sort of agitating for school desegregation, for housing desegregation, right? Like Parks, like King, right? Whether in the South or the North, this is seen as sort of the work of communists because the belief is that communists are going to sow division from within. This was the idea of the time. And so people who are saying, you know, who are advocating for a different way of being become seen as un-American, right? And so this way of sort of silencing dissent, right, part of that becomes about red-baiting people, right? And this happens to Parks and King during the Montgomery bus boycott. This happens to Parks and King, right, as they protest northern school segregation or northern housing segregation, right, that this is a charge that's leveled in this period in many ways to try to discredit or quiet down sort of activism that challenges the kind of structures of power again across the United States.
Thank you, Kurt, so much for the call. How much does she, and I'm wondering how possible this is for us to be able to derive strength in taking significant actions ourselves because of the strength of somebody else. I hadn't heard many of these stories before of some of the women who were working as domestics in Montgomery who were walking to work or participating in the boycott and were asked by their employers to, you know, cease and desist, get out of that movement. And they were very forthright in their comments to their bosses. Mm-hmm. We support this. You know, we're a part of this. We're going to stop working for you if you make this a condition of employment. Was that widespread, Jean?
I mean, I think everyone did not do it, right? But there are certainly, you know, I think for some people, I also talk about this, right? They let their white employers think whatever they want. They'd say, you know, they publicly with their employers say, no, I'm not in that movement. And then they go right down to the church after they get off work.
Right.
And then there are other people. And one of the interesting things I found with many of these, particularly many women, the point where they get extremely sort of defensive or angry is when some of these white employers will start to say, oh, well, King is leading you astray. He, you know, all sorts of rumors and stories come up around King, too, right? He has, you know, he does not committed to you. He has 20 cars. He has, you know, all sorts of things, right? And so it's interesting at a number of moments women talk about confronting their employers saying, don't talk about him like that. You can't talk about him. So there's a real protectiveness of King. And again, I think this speaks to sort of how amazing sort of it is and also how young King is, right? And so people very much, you know, feel very protective of him. I think there are, again, there's an amazing collection at the Amistad Center down in New Orleans at Tulane, right, that has all of this primary history on the boycott itself, which is where I got a lot of these quotes and interviews of people. They did them during the boycott itself, so it's a really rich research resource. And that's where you sort of hear many local people talking about, right, confronting their employers or just saying, I'm not, you know, I can eat without you. You can't, you know, I'm not going to let you say I can't do this. And then obviously other people were quiet and kept doing it anyway. So people took, I think, different paths through it.
Yeah. Danelle in Berlin. Hi, Danelle.
Hi. First of all, I want to tell Jean, thank you for this. I am a retired Milwaukee Public School teacher and was fortunate early in my career to, the first part of my career, not necessarily early, to hear Rosa Parks speak in person. I visited the Tulane, and researched some stuff there, and also the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta was very, very resourceful to me. But I felt like I was a little island about these myths that she was tired and she sat in the back of the bus and all this. And I'm going to certainly let people know about this concise book because I wish I had had it when I was teaching. So thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you broaden, the view of Parks, I think, only makes her more interesting and more teachable and more, I think, accessible to us as citizens.
Mm.
As, students.
And the search for the truth makes the job of a history professor sometimes a long process, but a rewarding one, I'm sure, right, Jean?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Thanks, Danelle, for the call. Bud in Rhinelander, hi.
Good morning. I have listened to your program, and I find it very informative. And one of the questions that arises in my mind is, we hear so much about Rosa Parks' arrest on the bus, but we never hear what the outcome of that arrest was. Could you shed some light on that for me, please?
Of course. So a couple of interesting things. So she's taken down to the jail. One of my favorite sort of stories is though she's put in a cell with a couple of other women, and one of the women is in there because her boyfriend was hitting her, and she takes a hatchet to him, doesn't kill him or anything, but so she's in there. She doesn't want to get back with the boyfriend, and she's not been allowed to call her family. She's been in jail for a month or so. And so Rosa Parks is in jail that night for probably about 3 hours. She is bailed out both by Edie Nixon and the Durr family and then also her husband. So she's there, maybe three-ish hours. And as she gets called to leave, she had told the woman she would call the woman's brother. And so the woman sort of surreptitiously throws a little piece of paper with the phone number down, out of the jail cell. And Parks picks it up and takes this piece of paper and the next day calls the woman's brother to say, she's in here, you need to, come help her. So I think that kind of speaks to sort of how Rosa Parks, both her outlook and the kind of core of her politics, that she's sort of thinking about these issues in the midst of this. She gets out of jail that night. They go back to the house and talk about whether she's willing to be a test case. And then that Monday, the day of the boycott, is actually organized around the day that she is arraigned in court. And she is found guilty. Interestingly, she'd been arrested on a city charge, but technically in Montgomery, you weren't supposed to be asked to give up your seat if there wasn't another seat for you. So they'd kind of changed the complaint to be against it, that she violated the state code, not the city code, because the state code doesn't have that extra provision that black people had fought for in Montgomery earlier in the century. So she is found guilty. She appeals. But the case that actually desegregates Montgomery's buses is a case filed into federal court in February. They realized that one of the tactics that had been used before to thwart sort of organizing was to hold up sort of cases in state court. And so so they actually file a separate case that doesn't have Parks on it, that has Claudette Colvin and Mary Louise Smith. It's called Browder v. Gale, directly into federal court in February of that year. And that is the case that the Supreme Court actually rules on, and that is the case that then desegregates Montgomery's buses.
Thank you, Bud, so much for the call. Jean Theo Harris, we are at the end of an hour. I could talk to you all day. Thank you so much for being with us and for such a comprehensive and interesting-to-read biography of a woman who's so worth reading about. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jean Theo Harris, our guest this hour. The book is The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, just been published, and very much worth reading. Particularly, you may want to start it today. Today is the 100th birthday of Mrs. Rosa Parks. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this show, and thanks to Amanda Magnus for producing this show as well. We'll be with you tomorrow. Great conversations ahead.